adesso. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It seems that everyone these days is connected to each other through social media. There's never a dull moment because in every idle moment, we pull out our phones or tablets and check Facebook or Twitter or post new information about ourselves on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Well, those are the leading social media apps, I suppose, but there are many others that people are tethered to as well. We feel informed and connected, but are we? Worse, are the trade-offs in terms of our personal privacy worth it? Are our social media connections good for us? Do they allow for healthy personal connections? Or are they actually weakening social bonds while at the same time giving away too much information? We're going to explore that this hour and how to log into healthier relationships with others and with social media. And we're joined by two psychologists to help in that task. Anita Blanchard is an associate professor of psychology and organization science at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Inyaka Nilamti is a licensed psychologist at Southeast Psych and an assistant professor of psychology at Queen's University of Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And I might want to add that if you'd like to join our conversation as we go through, we're going to be just social media oriented today. You do it at Charlotte. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. Before we talk about the good and the bad of social media, tell us how we got here. I mean, Facebook, I don't know how old it is now, but it's been around for almost a decade, maybe more, right? And arguably has changed the way many people stay in touch. If you're not on Facebook, you are out of the mainstream. I confess. And I have missed out on things because everybody informs people of everything on Facebook. Were other forms of communication that came before, the telegraph, the telephone, as important and essential? I guess essential is the word to use.
Well, I think the television would be the one that would be interesting. But
that's only one way.
It is one way, but people would go, and that was a problem with it. Why people wanted more communication with others. I think people would watch the TV show, and then they go to the water cooler the next day and talk about it.
Yes, wasn't that nice? There was something to talk about.
Well, now they can talk about it while it's happening on Twitter.
All right, well, let's talk. I wasn't planning to talk about that aspect.
Okay, that's fine.
But there are a lot of TV shows that now encourage you before the program starts to start your second screen experience, where while you're watching the show, you can fire up your iPad or whatever, and you can either go behind the scenes, find out more information about the show or that episode of the show, about the characters, and the actors sometimes tweet during the show, and that's all part of that whole experience. Are you really watching the show if you're doing all that stuff too?
I think so. And for me, it's the ability to, when something happens exciting, and I haven't really done it since Lost, so I'm kind of like, yeah, it's been a while, right? Yes, I know. But to have something happen.
That was a guilty pleasure, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was. It was. To get excited and be like, I can't believe that just happened, and go and look what everybody else said was really fun and felt like a group. I mean, they weren't friends of mine. It was like a flash mob, essentially. But it was nice to have other people besides my husband and me reacting to this.
So why? Why is that important? Why can't we wait till the next day at lunch or at the water cooler or on the road in if you have a carpool to talk about these things? Why do we have to do it right now?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is there is a belief that sort of it's an experience that we're having in the moment, and we can capitalize on it as much as possible right now in this moment. You know, we talk about sort of how everything is instant, right? So I want to feel great right now. I want to feel connected right now. And I think in a lot of ways that it allows for that.
Is it that we want to feel part of a group and part of something larger than ourselves so that we can get not only share our opinions and impressions, but also gather those of others? Or is it, is it the fact that it's broadcast to others so we get to have a wider audience for what we're thinking and feeling? What's at play here?
Well, Inyaka is a clinical psychologist, but I study groups, and I think the feeling of belonging into a group is a normal experience, and being able to react with others at the same time is really nice. It makes you feel included.
But I think it's a little bit of both. I think that there's a part of it where it's this idea that I want to feel part of a group and I want to feel connected. And the other piece is that I want to have a platform. And I want – there's a certain power that's felt because people get to hear what I think. So I think there's a combination.
Robin Williams' daughter cut off her Twitter feed yesterday because people were tweeting very unkind things about her father and how he died, including allegedly pictures of his corpse. So she cut it off. Explain that to me. There are very mean people out there saying and doing very, very mean things to people.
We call them trolls, at least in my world. And it's because they can do things anonymously and they can get away with it. Most people aren't like that. And what I've seen in my research is that the trolls get a lot of attention or a very small part of the people out there. It was a very small percentage. But yes, they can be very mean and awful.
So from a clinical psychologist's point of view, what's wrong with these people?
Well, I think about the same thing with bullying in middle school or high school. It's very much the same. It's now that people don't see me, there is this sense of an anonymity, so I can say the things that I think without having to worry about repercussions. So, you know, I see what happened with that as just an extension of the cyberbullying that happens at a younger age.
So this is allowing us to express our thoughts to a large audience without penalty, whereas if we'd said that in a crowd, we probably, A, wouldn't have said it, but B, if we had said it, we would have been instantly ostracized. Do those posting these things, yes, she cut off her Twitter feed, but is that, do the negative trolls feel the pain of being slapped in the face like that, or do they just go, ha, got her?
The trolls that I've known are like, ha, got her. But the key here is the anonymity. And if there's not anonymity, then there are repercussions. Certain social media I've seen where people tweet really negative things will start publishing their names and their addresses. Some cyberbullies, some teenagers have been punished in their real schools, high schools, for being trolls online.
So is this something that we've always wanted to be able to do but couldn't because the technology wasn't available until now? Or is this supplanting other avenues of doing exactly this that we've used for eons that we are now letting languish because we can do it in front of a screen and not really be in front of you?
Are you talking about bullying or
anything?
Anything.
The whole use of social media. Which is, you know, it's exponentially exploded over the last several years.
I think it's more of an extension of things that that we've always done. So if you think about other expressions, graffiti, or I think what social media has done is just allowed us to do it to a wider audience and instantly, and again with limited, depending on who you are and the context, with limited repercussions.
I think the next – go ahead.
Well, one thing we've studied is the great good place. Excuse me. when we didn't have television and we didn't have air conditioning, we'd all go and join with each other.
Right.
And now that we're in our homes, that the great good place, that third place, can happen online through these social media. So we're getting back to the connections that we wanted to have and naturally had – because we didn't have technology keeping us in our homes.
And we've talked about this third place. Is that what you just called it? In terms of the coffee shops.
Coffee shops, pubs in the UK.
Right. It's a place to go to be with others and socialize or just be around people even if you don't speak to them.
Right. It's not work and it's not home. It's a third place where you can go and interact with people.
Okay. So Facebook probably – I guess MySpace really started all this, but it's gone, I think, kind of.
Yeah.
But Facebook really was the one that everybody got involved in. And what made it so, and what makes it, because it's the nature of Facebook has changed over time, what makes it so powerful to the average, so attractive to the average user?
I mean, I work a lot with adolescents and young adults, and I think that there is the idea of, again, being heard, being able to sort of display this identity that they want to display. So I get to show the best part of me. So I think that there's a lot developmentally that people sort of see a lot of value in.
But sometimes people aren't showing the best part of themselves. They're showing things that maybe they think are the best part of themselves, but come back to bite them.
Well, and that's actually one of the things that I was thinking when you talked about sort of this idea of the great third place, mm-hmm. right, where people can feel connected. What the research is showing, especially with adolescents and young adults, is that we are the most connected now, but the most isolated, right? So I've got 1,000 Facebook friends, right. But I've got, you know, very limited real social interactions.
Well, I was going to ask about that. As long as you brought it up, let's talk about it. Is that isolation artificially constructed? Have we created that isolation by the very use of social media? Because we don't have to interact and we prefer, you know, it fascinates me that, for instance, when I talk to my niece in New Jersey, she much prefers to text than mm-hmm. talk on the phone. That's putting up a wall, isn't it? You can control texting. You can't control a conversation. Well, you can, but it's harder.
Well, I think it's hard to control texting. I mean,
you never know when it's over.
Well, but you also don't know. You can't read tones. You can't, you know. So when especially teens and young adults are trying to have serious conversations and they do them over text, you know, you're setting yourself up for a lot of misinterpretation and even more conflict. I do think that it's in some ways it has limited some of the skill, the social skills, the communication skills.
So have we shut ourselves off from people by the very use of these tools?
I'd say no. I think it depends. Let me say that. It depends. Yeah. If you're using the social media to connect with people that you're never going to interact with face-to-face, who live elsewhere, well, it may actually provide some connection and some social support that's very important to you. But the real benefits come from connecting on Facebook with your neighbors, with and maybe some work colleagues. There's some debate about that. But neighbors, people at your religious organization, people in your sports clubs, your friends and stuff, when you start making those connections online, when you meet with them face-to-face, actually it's a thicker bond between you. And that actually is really good.
And there's also information that you know already that you don't have to exchange. So there's this carpet that's been laid, essentially.
Right.
But I think, and so a lot of universities now, before students come in, they have Facebook pages, so mm-hmm. they get to know each other. And so it helps to build some of those relationships. But I think the caveat is making sure that you actually do the face-to-face after you've used the social media.
But the
use that doesn't always happen.
But as young people become more reliant, I'm particularly talking about kids now, on social media, has it become more difficult for them to have face-to-face conversations? Is it more uncomfortable to have them? Are they more comfortable in that technological communication world?
My students, I have to, I haven't done research, but I'm thinking about my students in my classes. They actually prefer the face-to-face interactions over the social media, at least with me, because I have both Facebook pages and Twitter pages. And they prefer the face-to-face interaction. They seem like they're able to communicate normally. Texting is an issue, but
I have a standard email that I cut and paste into email responses to students that says, there's a couple of lines at the bottom that says, in the future, I would encourage you to use more formal language when you are addressing a professor, mm-hmm. because sometimes it is very similar to what they would text.
Right.
So I think it depends. I think that we have to be much more intentional in making sure that we're teaching some of the social skills that they might not necessarily get otherwise.
Did the same thing happen when the telephone came in? When you couldn't see the person you were talking to, but you could hear them? I mean, did we have to teach telephone social skills? Maybe, there's no time to answer that. Think about it. We'll come back on the other side. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Levine Museum, presenting LGBTQ Perspectives on Equality, a combination of exhibits that explore the history of Charlotte's gay and transgender community. Details at museumofthenewsouth.org. Tomorrow we're going to talk about something I have been curious about now for a very long time. It wasn't my idea to do this show. I'm just glad it's coming our way. And that is tattoos. If you watch television, every actor on TV all of a sudden has a tattoo. What is that all about? Where is this phenomenon coming from? And there are tattoo parlors all over the city of Charlotte and all over the country now. Some of this is really high art. We're going to talk to somebody from the National Geographic Society who's looked into the history of tattoos and to two local tattoo artists about all of this tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new car sales in the U.S. are at their highest level in 8 years. And technology is changing Americans' relationship with autos, the latest trend in driving and car buying.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about social media with two psychologists. Anita Blanchard is Associate Professor of Psychology and Organization Science at UNC Charlotte, and Inyaka Nilamti is a licensed psychologist at Southeastern Psych and an Assistant Professor of Psychology at Queen's University of Charlotte. When the telephone, when other instruments of communication, non-face-to-face communication came in, they actually did an episode on this, in where it was part of an episode of Downton Abbey when the family got their first telephone. And it rang, and people just looked at it like, now what? What do I say? So there were things that came into being specifically to – there was telephone etiquette.
Right. People had to learn how to answer it. And when hello, it became a word that people used for answering this. And
you know, that was one of the conversations that we had, was that every parent sort of taught their kids, here's how you answer the phone in the house. I know my parents said, you know, this is how you're supposed to answer the phone. So they had to teach.
I mean, the telephone and the computer were thought to be only valuable to businesses. Mm-hmm. The head of IBM thought that they would make 7 computers and
the whole world.
Nobody would need a computer for anything. How wrong they were. So they have become essential tools of modern life. Has social media become an essential tool of modern life? If you aren't on social media, do you exist?
Well, of course you exist. But I do worry, actually. When social media and the computers first started out, there was some research concern of the haves and the have-nots. And the concern of the have-nots were the people who were impoverished and the elderly. And we're noticing now that the older people are getting online and really enjoying it, and impoverished people, it's not so much of an issue, especially with phones. But for people who consciously decide to stay out of Facebook, I don't have any research about it, but I wonder if they're going to be left further and further behind and out of society. Because I know that's a controversial statement, but it's interesting. As a researcher, I'm interested to know what's going to happen.
Well, it would be is it not unlike if you refused to have a telephone in your house, or if you refused to have a TV in your house, or if you refused to carry a cell phone? Are you really part of the mainstream if you're off of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest and all the other ones?
Well, I don't think you cease to exist. I think that there are other ways of getting information. So I work with some adolescents, some young adults. I know a lot of people who have chosen to stay out of social media, and they are successful. But I do think that depending on what you do, there is a certain value that social media adds. And so you might miss out on some of that.
So social media does in fact augment someone's social interaction and their lives.
I think it can.
It can, I guess.
You have to use it right? Is that what you're telling me?
I think a lot of people who are not on Facebook and Twitter think that they have to be on posting their breakfast and their lunch and commenting about everything they're doing, where in fact most people are lurkers. Most people just read and look at other people's pages as opposed to posting all the time. And that's okay. That's fine. Getting on once a week for 5 minutes is enough. Getting on a couple of times a day is enough. I mean, it depends on what that person really, you know, what someone wants out of it. I would be concerned. I think there is some growing concern about organizations where they go to search for employees, especially young employees, and they can't find a Facebook account or a Twitter account. I think they kind of wonder, like, is this someone who's going to be able to bring the new energy and blood into the organization?
But I think that goes both ways. We actually had an intern this summer who one of the psychologists went and pulled his Twitter feed for the last couple of years. And
Yeah, be careful about that.
So I think again, yeah. I think it can go both ways, and I think
so. He didn't get the job, is what you're
saying? No, he was already interning there, okay. And so so I think as a sort of an example, he sort of pulled his Twitter feed for the last couple of years and sort of said, okay, so here's what you've posted over the last 2.5 years.
That might want to think about that.
That could have sort of have closed a lot of doors.
Yeah,
and he closed. He's closed down that account since then. Right. So I think it can go both ways.
Hmm. Students, especially as they're starting to graduate, are very sensitive to their Facebook, what's on their Facebook, and what's on their Twitter accounts, and become much more conservative about what they post. I think that's reasonable. I think it's a very good idea, actually.
One area psychologist, Dr. Mary Gail Frawley O'Day, who's director of counseling at Presbyterian Psych, says that although social media is here to stay and can be a positive influence on children, it can also endanger the minds, bodies, and spirits of our young people. Would you agree with that? And if so, why?
I don't know why it would endanger their bodies. I mean, I'm more concerned about.
Well, I suppose if you put your picture on Facebook and there's a lurker, who stalks you, then you could be in trouble.
Yes, and so I would say I think it can, absolutely. But I think that there are a lot of things that can endanger the minds, bodies, and spirits of our young people. I think that social media. I think part of the reason that it's more dangerous is because, you know, once something's posted, it's posted. Right, mm-hmm. It's there.
Forever.
It's very hard to control things once they sort of get out into the great wide world. I think that especially for teens, impulse control is a big issue for adolescents and young adults. And so, you know, if I'm making decisions that are sort of rash and in the moment, mm-hmm. whether that's connecting with strangers or again, making other poor choices, then yes, it could really endanger.
I would encourage parents to be on top of social media, which is challenging because it means they actually have to catch up. Yes. And that's important.
And setting boundaries, helping them to set boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Setting boundaries.
Well, what if your child cuts you off from, defriends you or... Can you I don't even know this. Can you turn off a Twitter feed to certain people? Can you turn your feed off to certain people? Or does it have to be on?
You can change privacy settings so that people can't see that. And that might be a rule of using it. I mean.
And I've got parents that sort of set all kinds of rules. I've got some parents who, who have the passwords to all of their children's social media. Mm-hmm. I've got some parents who have made their children shut down their social media.
How do you know they haven't just opened up another account with
their password? And that happens sometimes as well.
One of your areas of research, Anita, is looking into the effects of online and virtual communications on organizations and mm-hmm. society. What's the difference between online and virtual communication?
Researchers use both terms, so I do too.
Have the effects been good, bad, or indifferent?
Well, it's interesting. It's really a hot topic, and we find that for some organizations – some research we've looked at, when employees are communicating with each other, it actually affects their attachment to the organization. So when employees share a Facebook account with each other, they actually have a stronger identity with the organization because it's friends that they have at work and they like the organization better.
So if you're asked to leave the organization or you're laid off by the organization and you've developed not only the fact that you work in this organization, but you have Facebook relationships in this organization, doesn't that make the departure that
well,
much more
always
painful?
There's a psychological break that has to happen between the person and the organization. They may still keep the connections with the friends because those are the closer connections and have that psychological break with the organization. Or they may need to stop being friends with some of their Facebook friends.
Some parents have been very concerned about children spending too much time on social media, too much time texting, too much time tweeting, too much time reading tweets, too much time posting and reading Facebook comments from friends. And of course, adults are accused of doing this too, because some adults are married. They're glued. They're soldered to their cell phones. What's that all about? I mean, teenagers used to be accused of always being on the phone. They're never on the phone now. They're always texting. But it's the same thing, right?
It is.
What's that all about?
Well, I mean, part of it is at that age, peer support and peer relationships are the most important, right? So the most important goes from being your parents to your peer group. And so social media is a way to stay connected. And they feel like it allows them to be connected to.
Why not just go and be connected someplace in person or be on the phone and actually be able to hear the voice of the person they're talking to?
You know, it's funny. I always was on the phone and then I started texting and it's so much faster. And there's a joke I've heard, like, unless you're on fire or you're, you know, you've broken something, don't call me. I mean, text me because it's a lot faster for me to read it. So I think that they can communicate faster with more people.
It's faster because it's only the pertinent information. It's not the hello, how are you, what
we've kind of gone beyond the typical salutations. You can get right to the issue of things and kind of exchange the core of what you want to communicate with.
But I don't think it's always faster. I do think that there is – I think it's easier to send a text.
It's easier.
Than it is to pick up the phone and have a conversation.
Because it's quicker? Because you can just get the gist of it out and stop? That's the end of it?
I think it's less anxiety-provoking. I think, you know, to call someone and say, hey, can you know, do you want to go out is – that's terrifying. Because you might get no.
Right.
And then I've got to figure out how do I hide that or how do – you know, and
how do I end the conversation?
So I can send a text and ask, you know, and you can say no, and you have no idea how I've been impacted. So I do think that there's a part of the
social media. Yeah, but when you send the text saying you want to come over, you want to hang out, you want to go to the movies, you want to do whatever, you might be texted back no. So what's the difference in the anxiety level of being having an actual conversation with somebody about that versus getting a tweet or a text?
They can't see you go, oh. I can't see you be sad.
But as the instigator, as the person saying, would you like to go out? And if that's a scary thing to say on the phone because you might be told no.
Face to face.
What's the difference? You're still sending the text message that says, would you like to go out? And you still may get a no.
But I think that there is something about sort of private shame versus that right, so someone else knows that I've been rejected. But I think what parents will say too, though, is, you know, they get to see the flip side. So if you know, my child sends a text and someone doesn't and they take more than 5 minutes to respond, that feels like a rejection. Wow. And so then I get to see the meltdown that happens on this end, but the other person might not.
They might not have gotten your text. They might be busy.
Or they might be busy or, you know, so I do think that it sets up this expectation for this instant response and that means that, you know, I'm accepted and there's a whole lot more that sometimes can be attached to that.
Now, Anita, you don't look at this. I mean, you're a psychologist and you deal with the group dynamics of this, et cetera, but you're not looking at this from the 30,000-foot level. You actually are involved in this and have been for a long time. You describe yourself as the queen geek wherever you have worked because you adopted computer use in 1984, which was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So how involved are you personally in social media, and what impact has it had on your life?
Well, I can tell you that around Charlotte right now, people are laughing because, yes, I am Queen Geek, and they would consider that. I use it a lot to connect with friends, to find out about other people, to make work connections. One of the crazy things is at one point I had a separate personal and then I had my work colleagues in a separate place. And I said, I'm going to change my boundaries and let them all see me. And the both professional and personal relationships between myself and my colleagues have increased. In fact, I had someone from NYU, a very prestigious researcher, text me and asked me for some of my papers a couple of weeks ago. And I'm like, well, that would not have happened if she and I were not Facebook friends, like fully friends.
Right.
So I know I'm not normal, and as far as that goes, I fully understand that.
How does that make you feel?
I'm
just a joke.
I know it's just. I know I am not normal in many, many ways. So there we go. It's out in the open.
That's a
surprise to no one.
My psychologist joke. You can't afford my hourly rate. Inyaka, you talked a second ago about how communicating through texting or tweeting may be less anxiety producing than actually making the phone call, but I read yesterday that in working with young people at the collegiate level, which you do, and you also see younger patients in private practice, you say that there's a great deal of additional social stress that teens are experiencing as the result of social media. So which is it, less stress or more?
My students get frustrated with me because I think I like to say that the answer to most things in psychology is it depends.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, I was talking to a teenager a couple of weeks ago, and she'd posted a picture on Instagram. She says, "Oh, wow, I've already gotten so and so, you know, I've already gotten 150 likes. Wow." Mm-hmm. So there is this, you know, I think in some ways there could be some self-esteem attached to how many likes I get or how many people retweet my tweets.
And you say the number of retweets and the likes you receive does not equal self-worth.
And so helping them to detach those things, I think, can be very challenging, especially for young people as they're trying to figure out who they are, right? So, you know, if I try out these different identities online and this one gets more acceptance than this one, then I might be a little bit more likely to sort of go this way, even though that might not necessarily really be me. So I think it adds an additional layer of stress to navigate. And so people already think, you know, already talk about adolescence as being sort of challenging in some ways anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think it makes it a lot.
And is some of the stress and anxiety coming from the fact that we feel like we have to stay in touch, because if we don't respond or if we don't know what's going on, we're going to be out of the loop and we're going to be considered not a participant in the group. Therefore, I'll be ostracized by the group. And now that there's more than one platform, I have to keep up with all this stuff on all of these platforms. It's like a never-ending job.
FOMO, right? Fear of missing out.
No,
that's.
But you have to follow all. You have to be on Facebook. You have to be on Twitter.
Oh, I don't know. I think some people prefer one medium over the other.
Okay.
So I think some people, like I've had Facebook friends who are now who are kind of migrating to Instagram. They prefer having that to be their way of interacting. I have a friend who hates Facebook, but she and I are connecting with her family, with her kids. I'm Instagram friends connected with her kids. I love it, and that. They love sharing with me. Some people like Twitter. I'm not. I do a little bit of Twitter, but I like Facebook and Instagram more.
And some folks like Twitter because it's short, right?
Right.
So it's I've got some folks who will not use Facebook anymore, but they.
And when I say Instagram, I'm on Instagram like 5 minutes a day. I just look through and then I'm done. 5 minutes a day. It's a commercial, right?
A commercial.
Maybe I'm listening to NPR commercials. I don't know.
No, we don't have to. No. That would be wrong. We've talked a little bit about social isolation and how this does isolate you, the use of this, too frequent
it
use
can.
Of this, or the, dependent, yeah, the dependence can. On this can isolate you actually socially. On the other hand, you say in Yucca that it has opened up new worlds for people, particularly young people, that they couldn't have gotten into without this format.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about, you know, maybe those who are a little bit more socially awkward, or it allows you to connect with other teens. You know, I've got teens who have got, you know, friends in other cities, and they might struggle a little bit more socially in their schools now. So
because of the use of social media?
No, because of other things, right? So because they are socially anxious or there's mm-hmm. something else that's going on. So it does allow them to expand their social world. So.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more and we'll read some twits or some tweets in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Raptor Center. Thursday night flight series, today Master Bacon Food Truck Acoustic Music, and the Carolina Brewmasters Homebrew Challenge, 6 to 8 p.m. Details, CarolinaRaptorCenter.org. New car sales in the country are at their highest level in 8 years, but technology is changing Americans' relationship with cars. Diane Rehm and her guest will talk about the latest trends in driving and in car buying coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation about social media, you'll have to use social media to get into the conversation. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
Hi, this is David Greene from NPR. Think you don't make a difference? Well, at WFAE, you do. When you become a contributor to WFAE, you make a significant difference to the station and to the community. And it doesn't take much. All contributions are welcome. Giving makes a difference to you, your neighbors, and WFAE because you're helping to pay for the programming that matters to you. Make an impact on our community today by contributing online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Mike Collins. We're talking about social media with Dr. Inyaka Nailamti, who is a licensed psychologist and at Southeast Psych and an assistant professor of psychology at Queen's University of Charlotte. Anita Blanchard, also Dr. Anita Blanchard, associate professor of psychology and organization science at UNC Charlotte. We were talking about social awkwardness among young people, and I'm curious as to whether this is helping them get past that or whether it's contributing it to it, because you say, Inyaka, that social media has significantly changed how young people develop social skills and communicate. If you're only doing it with your thumbs on a phone and looking at a screen, when you're actually confronted with somebody, do you have the social skills to communicate with them?
Again, it depends. So I think it does. I think it does require additional learning. And I tell parents a lot about making sure that they're intentional in teaching some of those skills. And I think in the past it felt like they just sort of picked those things up. And so now it feels like you actually have to be intentional.
Yeah.
So I talk to parents a lot about modeling, you know, making sure that they're not on their phones all the time, or demonstrating good social skills. But I think for teens who are socially anxious and would choose to isolate themselves anyway, I think this medium actually allows them to break down some of those barriers. So they may be much more willing to take some real risks in real life.
This may sound like a silly question, but if tweets arrived to us quickly through the mail, snail mail. Mm-hmm. We got little postcards every few minutes delivered to us on paper. If Facebook pages were like yearbook pages that were delivered to us every hour on paper, would this be attractive, or are we seduced by the glow? I'm serious.
No,
are we seduced by the glow of the screen, which attracts our eye and we feel some kind of got to be there, got to be part of this device? Is the device part of this as well as the content?
Well, I have a funny thought about that. When I was doing my dissertation, I was reading War and Peace because I had some free time. And they had actually surf mail. So they had tweets. Uh-huh. They would send each other, the rich in Russia would send each other little cards of messages and have their surf run over to somebody else and then run back. So this, you know, this way of communicating has been around for hundreds of years. We just haven't had the ability for everyone to have it. Just the extremely rich with their servants had the ability to do this.
But we seem unable to put down our cell phones. I'm guilty of this too. I'm guilty. If there's a nanosecond of downtime, I'm going to turn the phone on and I'm going to look for something.
Right.
I'm either going to check my email or check something that's coming in a one-sentence thing or a news alert, or I'm going to go to the NPR site, or I'm going to go to USA Today or the New York Times and find out what's going on in the world. I can't not do it.
When I'm trying to help, when I do training seminars and try to help people in productivity, tell them to turn their alarms off and only check their email certain times, because it is like a rat to a bell. You're getting a little
treat.
But
what is it? What's so seductive about it? What is it? You're the psychologist here.
Honestly, I'm not sure it's about necessarily the technology. I think, you know, I think about like how many people feel like they need to feel silence, you know, so, or nervous energy, right? So it's something, it's there, I can fiddle with it. So I'm not, and then it pulls me in. I can get sucked into it very quickly. So I'm not necessarily even convinced that it's about the technology. It's just sort of, okay, I've got some downtime. I need to feel like I'm being productive. So let me check, you know, the news feed or check Facebook or check my email.
It's stimulating. It's interesting sometimes.
Is it that we don't have to be bored anymore because we can always stimulate ourselves with something on that screen? Or is it that we don't want to be alone with our thoughts?
Yes. I think both of those are reasonable, and the ability to be bored is important. My children are home this summer. I want them to be bored and to figure out how to solve that problem without technology. I want to figure out how to be bored and to do something else. There is something good about putting it down and stepping away and saying, I'm not going to look at this for a while. That's a very healthy thing to do.
You're nodding at all of this.
Oh, absolutely. There was a research study that came out last year that talked about the decrease in creativity mm-hmm. of children because they don't have to use their imaginations, right? Because, you know, you sit on the DS for the five-hour car ride to the beach during the summer. And so I think that there is a lot of value to having empty time where you've got to figure out a different way to fill it. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there's a part of that.
They also don't have to count cows or sing 99 bottles of beer on the wall, which is a relief to the parents,
absolutely.
Alice on Twitter writes, being a girl on Twitter often means having to take time off when messages get violent or abusive. I took a week off after one of my tweets got retweeted a bunch. The messages were horrifying.
Oh, that's awful. Sexism is still pretty alive and well out there on the internet.
Is that because most of the geeks are guys?
Yes. Oh, it's interesting, though. Facebook is mostly dominated by women, uh-huh. and Twitter is mostly dominated. And, Google Plus is just horrible.
Is it because it's all men?
Oh, yeah.
Is that because it's short?
I have no idea.
Men are nonverbal, you know. We're told.
Google Plus, it's supposed to be like a combination of Twitter, and I don't go there. It is this wild open.
But I'm not sure if it's necessarily because of the gender differences. I think that there's probably, you know, I have a lot of adolescents even who will say I had to take a break off of Facebook because I realized that, you know, when I would spend a couple of minutes, I found myself feeling sad or feeling isolated or feeling so. I think.
Well, maybe they were part of that experiment. Let's talk about that for a second, because if these social media sites were merely neutral platforms where you can send and receive and participate on your terms with your associates, that would be one thing if they acted as a conveyance for that. But Facebook, as you know, recently conducted this experiment with its users by feeding certain of them only negative news to gauge their emotional response to that diet of negativity. And some people got really positive news, and they were judging that too. First of all, from a psychologist's point of view, was that responsible? Was it a harmless action? Or is that reprehensible?
This was, in my world, this has been a huge thing, and actually spent some time reviewing the actual study about what happened. The real issue is that scientists have to go through an internal review board. So we have to have people review our work to make sure that what we're doing is ethical. And Facebook's claim has been that when you sign up, they're going to do internal research, which all companies do. I mean, everything you sign up for, they're doing internal research. The problem is they then tried to turn this into science. And it's a bit of a complicated thing of what they did. They didn't just feed people negative or positive news. What they did is they, and this is pretty impressive, they had technology to look at what somebody was seeing on, for your Facebook feed. They'd see if you were getting a lot of positive or a lot of negative. And then they'd reduce your ability to see those posts on your news feed. It's from your friends, not from advertisers or from news. It's from your friends. And so they reduced, the number of positive things you saw and wanted to see if you would reduce the number of positive posts things you said in your status updates. So they were reducing positive for some people and reducing negative for some people. They wanted to see if that would reduce the positive and the negative post you had that you would post yourself. And they're trying to look at emotional contagion. So we know a lot of research that.
Why do they want to know that?
That's kind of interesting. Emotional contagion usually has to happen when we're interacting face to face and we can see each other's nonverbal.
But I mean, what's in it for them to know that?
Well, science would think that was interesting to see if we could do it.
I got you.
Virtually.
Yeah,
sure. Absolutely.
They, I'm sure, have other research they're doing internally to see if you're going to buy. But here's the part that keeps getting missed in the news media about it. Yeah, they did find an effect. So if you had less positive words in yours, you did less positive in your own social media. But it only affected – of the 100% of the variance we can explain of what you posted, it explained 1%. Yeah. Less than 1%. A minuscule amount. It's
well, they didn't know that going in.
Well, they published it. I wouldn't have gotten through me as a peer reviewer. I'd have been like, this is a BS study. You can't – this is not explaining anything.
But I think part of the backlash was, you know, especially if you think about research and deception.
Right. We agreed to – I mean, unfortunately, we often agree to marketing research and political science research, and that people are trying to manipulate our behaviors and our emotions based on the advertisements that we see. Now, that happens all the time, and, you know, people don't get worked up about it. But I it does work me up to think somebody would – a scientist, you're supposed to trust us, would do some sort of science manipulation without some form of informed consent.
Yeah. I think that's the big
well,
piece.
Because
what if it gets bigger?
Excuse me, but you do. And you're consenting to everything.
Sure.
And nobody reads it.
And nobody reads it. You know.
But it's not science. It's marketing, internal marketing research, not science research. And
they say we can use all of your data, right? We can use any of the data that you post.
And that is my
– I think that that's the issue.
Doesn't that make that scary and make it less valuable and make it something to be automatically suspicious of, because they are in the business at Google – at Facebook, rather, to make – they're all in the business to make money. They have to make money because they can't support the platform if they don't make money. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they wanted to know if you were getting too much negativity on your feed, you wouldn't respond positively to whatever advertising you responded to. So maybe we should control the number of negative things that you see. Maybe that's what that was all about.
My reading of this – I mean, maybe. But my reading of the study is they really wanted to study emotional contagion. They may be doing that research all over the place internally, but what came out was this emotional contagion.
So is that the tip of the iceberg?
We just
found out about this, but there are other things going on not only
that was
with
in
them,
2012.
But others?
Right.
It's 2012.
That study was done in 2012.
There's other things going on with other platforms, not
just
them.
Oh, yeah. I think we should. They're all out there to make money. They want you to click on things. I think we should all be concerned about it.
Well, and, you know, but one of the things that you said was, doesn't it make it scary? Yes. Does it make it valueless? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I think that those are two different things.
Buyer beware. Okay. Nicole on Twitter, in response to the question about being asked out via text, she said, I'd rather text you my answer. Bill emails, as a secondary teacher since the early 70s, I have noticed two major changes driven by social media. First, students post items of intimate items that are intimate that they would rarely have said to any but a small circle of friends with plausible deniability and no paper electronic trail for parents and teachers to see. Second, it's the velocity of the information. Slights that used to happen at school took days to brew, and now a small issue brews overnight on social media and is ready to explode when third-degree friends of the principals bump into each other the next morning. I love to post and text to my students for the convenience, but even the brightest students don't seem to understand the difference in benefits of various methods of communication. A single phone conversation is far better for
A
single phone conversation is far better for negotiating complexity than is a series of texts or emails, which work so well for passing a single item of information.
Absolutely.
And I think part of our job is to, as educators, is to help our students realize, when should you text? When should you stop by my office? When should you email? You know, it's different. It's social. It's media choice. You need to pick the right medium for the right communication.
And sometimes that's even sort of not using social media in
some cases.
So, you know, I think that part of it is really educating.
Are we still feeling our way through this, or is it something that we have, after 10 years of this, should pretty much understand what the differences are? No?
I think we might be at the end of the beginning of social media. I think, like, Facebook kind of appeared out of nowhere, and then everyone was using it. I'm sure I'm horrible at predicting what technology is going to happen in the future.
Right.
But there could be something coming up soon. We're going to have to learn a new way of interacting with that.
Okay. Sherry emails, I can text and multitask. actually have done shows on that, and you can't multitask.
No, absolutely.
But I can text and multitask. Talking on the phone has to be immediate. I can respond to a text after I've finished uploading or unloading the dryer. I can also control the time and conversation to better suit my activities at the time for friends who want to occupy my ear for 20 minutes at a time. FYI, I'm almost 60. That is true.
That
is
true.
You really
right?
are in control if you use that sort of communication device.
I agree. That's why I think it's attractive.
But I think that that also requires you to be very intentional about using it in a controlled way. So, again, sometimes we don't necessarily have that skill set. Mm-hmm. So, especially if you're talking about adolescents and young adults.
Okay. Rachel from Twitter, a lot of people go through stages with their social networking. They delve into it, then feel weird and disconnect, and then come back. Why?
I don't know why. That's a great research question. I think you get in, you find it's exciting and new, and then you're maybe disillusioned with all relationships that happens. Step back and then come back at a different level. I don't know.
I think it happens for different reasons. Again, I've had some folks who – you know, say, okay, it's too overwhelming. I realize that I'm spending too much time on it. Or maybe I got in trouble. So there could be a lot of reasons why sort of say, okay, it's time to take a step back, sort of gather myself, and then maybe.
Or just take a vacation from it.
Yeah.
Venture back
that's
in.
Good.
Yeah.
Jay and Charlotte emails, being a bit older, I found it hard to identify with this like obsession. Thumbs up. Maybe I've reached the age where I no longer worry about what people think about me. I actually think the whole like concept, and I know it's a shorthand thing, but the whole thing just sounds juvenile to me. Like me on Facebook. Oh, come on. Give me a break. Angie from Twitter says, I want to delete Facebook almost weekly for various reasons, but I haven't because of the connections.
Yeah.
Woe is me.
True.
Men's Health reports that not only do Facebook users boast a high divorce rate, there are lasting results that can continue to affect a person's health in the long run, like stress, anxiety, and paranoia. I have 10 seconds. Do you agree with that? Is that just a Men's Health advertising marketing gimmick to get you to read the magazine?
I would like to see that research.
Of course, anything to excess is bad.
Right. Exactly.
Your grandmother was right about that.
Absolutely.
So all things in moderation. And understand what you're doing and the impact it may be
and
having.
And think. I'd say think before you post.
Dr. Inyaka Nailamti and Dr. Anita Blanchard from UNC Charlotte and Queen's University, thank you for the hour.